Rubashov could not call back to his memory the visual image of Bogrov, but he saw the outlines of his gigantic figure, his awkward trailing arms, the freckles on his broad, flat face with the slightly turned-up nose. They had been roommates in exile after 1905. Rubashov had taught him reading, writing, and the fundamentals of historical thought. Since then, wherever Rubashov might happen to be, he received twice a year a handwritten letter, ending invariably with the words, "Your comrade, faithful unto the grave, Bogrov." "They are coming," tapped 402. "Stand at the spy hole. Drum. Pass it on." He pattered through the dark to the cell door and waited. All was silent. Again, the ticking in the wall. "Now." Along the corridor came the low, hollow sound of subdued drumming. It was not tapping nor hammering. The men in the cells 380 to 402, who formed the acoustic chain and stood behind their doors like a guard of honor in the dark, produced the muffled, solemn sound of a roll of drums. Rubashov stood with his eyes pressed to the spy hole and joined the chorus by beating with both hands rhythmically against the concrete door. To his astonishment, the stifled wave was carried on to the right, through 406 and beyond. At the same time, Rubashov heard to his left, at some distance still from the limits of his range of vision, the grinding of iron doors being rolled back on their slidings. The drumming to his left became slightly louder. Rubashov knew that the iron door, which separated the isolation cells from the ordinary ones, had been opened. Keys jangled. The iron door was shut again. Now he heard the approach of steps accompanied by sliding and slipping noises on the tiles. The drumming to the left rose in a wave, a steady, muffled crescendo. Rubashov's field of vision was still empty. The sounds approached quickly. Now he distinguished also a moaning and whimpering like the whimpering of a child. The steps quickened, the drumming to the left faded, to the right it swelled. Rubashov drummed. He pressed his eye to the Judas, rising and falling rhythmically on his toes as he drummed. He saw only the stale yellowish light of the electric bulb in the corridor. There was nothing to be seen save the iron doors of 401 to 407. But the roll of drums rose, and the creaking and whimpering approached. Suddenly, figures entered his field of vision. They were there. A second later, they had passed. Two dimly lit figures had walked past, in uniform, dragging between them a third, whom they held under the arms. The middle figure hung slack and yet with doll-like stiffness from their grasp, stretched out at length, face turned to the ground, belly arched downwards. The legs trailed after, the shoes skated along on the toes. Whitish strands of hair hung over the face, turned towards the tiles, with the mouth wide open. Drops of sweat clung to it. Out of the mouth, spittle ran thinly down the chin. They dragged him out of Rubashov's field of vision, further to the right and down the corridor. The moaning and whimpering gradually faded away. But before they had turned the corner at the end of the corridor, by the barber's shop, Bogrov bellowed out loudly twice. Rubashov heard his own name. He heard it clearly. Rubashov, Rubashov. And silence fell. Rubashov was lying on his bunk again. He still had the drumming in his ears, but the silence was now a true silence, empty and relaxed. Rubashov, Rubashov. That last cry was branded ineffaceably in his acoustic memory. The optic image was less sharp. Only now did the white hair occur to him. What had they done to Bogrov? What had they done to this sturdy sailor to draw this childish whimpering from his throat? Had Arlova whimpered in the same way when she was dragged along the corridor? Up till now, he had never imagined Oliver's death in such detail. It had always been for him an abstract occurrence that had left him with a feeling of strong uneasiness, but he'd never doubted the logical rightness of his own behaviour. Now his past mode of thought seemed lunacy. The whimpering of Bogrov unbalanced the logical equation. The vision of Arlova's legs in their high-heeled shoes trailing along the corridor upset the mathematical equilibrium. The unimportant factor had grown to the immeasurable, the absolute. Exhausted, Lubashov fell asleep, his head leaning against the wall, the pince-nez before his shut eyes. He woke up because the electric light in his cell was suddenly turned on. A figure stood next to his bed, looking at him. "Do you feel ill?" asked Ivanov. Lubashov blinked at him, blinded by the light. "Would you like some brandy?" Ivanov asked. Without waiting for a reply, he hobbled to the spy hole and called out something into the corridor. "Have you been arrested too?" Lubashov asked. "No, just came to visit you." "Give me a cigarette." Lubashov inhaled deeply once or twice and his gaze became clearer. He lay back, smoking, and looked at the ceiling. The cell door opened. The warder brought a bottle of brandy and a glass. Ivanov sat down on the edge of Rubashov's bunk and filled the glass. "Drink," he said. Lubashov emptied the glass. The mistiness in his head cleared. Events and persons arranged themselves in time and space. He stood up and walked up and down the cell once or twice until his head became quite clear. Then he stopped in front of Ivanov, who was still sitting on the edge of the bunk. "What are you doing here?" Lubashov asked. "I want to talk to you. Lie down again and drink some more brandy." Lubashov blinked at him through his pince-nez. "Until now, I was tempted to believe you were acting in good faith. Now I see you're a swine. Get out of here." Ivanov did not move. "Do be good enough to give the reasons for this assertion." Lubashov leaned back against the wall of number 406 and looked down at Ivanov. "You knew of my friendship with Bogrov. Therefore, you took care that Bogrov, or what was left of him, was taken past my cell on his last journey as a reminder. The whole thing was calculated to put me into a state of depression. In this darkest hour, Comrade Ivanov appears as a savior, with a bottle of brandy under his arm. Follows a touching scene of reconciliation. We fall into each other's arms, exchange moving war memories, and incidentally sign the statement with my confession. Whereupon, the prisoner sinks into a gentle slumber. Comrade Ivanov leaves on the tip of his toes with a statement in his pocket and is promoted a few days later. Now have the goodness to get out of here." Ivanov lifted the glass from the floor, filled it and drank it. "Well, I propose the following agreement. You let me speak for 5 minutes without interrupting me, and you listen with a clear head to what I am saying. And if after that you still insist on my going, I will go." "I'm listening." Lubashov glanced at his watch. "In the first place," said Ivanov, "it was intentional that Bogrov was taken past your cell. This trick, however, was not arranged by me, but by my colleague, Gletkin, against my express instructions. I should never have made such a mistake, not out of any regard for your feelings, but because it is contrary to my knowledge of your psychology. You have recently shown a tendency to humanitarian scruples and other sentimentalities of that sort. The scene with Bogrov must only intensify your depression and moralistic leanings. That could be foreseen. Only a bungler in psychology like Gletkin could have made such a mistake. Now, the brandy I ordered you because you were not in full possession of your wits when I came in. It is not in my interest to make you drunk. That only drives you further into your moral exaltation. I need you sober and logical. And my only interest is that you should calmly think your case to a conclusion. For when you have thought the whole thing to a conclusion, then, and only then, will you capitulate. Rubashov shrugged his shoulders. But before he could say anything, Ivanov cut in. Answer me only one thing. If you became convinced of the logical necessity and the objective rightness of capitulating, would you then do it? Go away. It's no use, said Rubashov. Why do you want me to go? Why don't you answer the question I asked? Ivanov looked Rubashov mockingly in the face. Then he said slowly, emphasizing each word, because you are afraid of me. Because my way of thinking and of arguing is your own, and you are afraid of the echo in your own head. In a moment you'll be calling out, "Ooh, get thee behind me, Satan!" Rubashov did not answer. He was walking to and fro by the window in front of Ivanov. He felt hopeless and incapable of clear argument. His consciousness of guilt, which Ivanov called moral exaltation, could not be expressed in logical formulae. It lay in the realm of the grammatical fiction. At the same time, every sentence spoken by Ivanov did in fact evoke an echo in him. He felt he ought never to have let himself be drawn into this discussion. He felt as if he were on a smooth, slanting plane, down which he slid irresistibly. Rubashov walked up and down in front of the window. After a while, he said, "Why did you execute Bogrov?" "Oh, because of the submarine question. Bogrov advocated the construction of submarines of large tonnage and long range. The party is in favor of small submarines with a short range. Both parties had valid technical arguments, but the actual problem lay in quite a different sphere. Big submarines mean a policy of aggression to further world revolution. Small submarines mean coastal defense, that is, self-defense and postponement of world revolution. The latter is the point of view of number one and the party. Bogrov had a very strong following in the Admiralty and amongst the officers of the old guard. It would not have been enough to put him out of the way. He also had to be discredited. A trial was projected to unmask the partisans of big tonnage as saboteurs and traitors. We had already brought several little engineers to the point of being willing to confess publicly to whatever we liked. But Bokrov wouldn't play the game. He declaimed up to the very end the advantages of big tonnage and world revolution. In a public trial, he would only have created confusion among the people. There was no other way possible than to liquidate him administratively. Would you not have done the same thing in our position? You did not hear him whimpering? No, I did not hear it, but I have heard and seen similar things. What of it?
Rubashov was silent. It was no use to try and explain it. The whimpering and the muffled drumming again penetrated his ears like an echo. One could not express that.
What of it? Repeated Ivanov.
As no answer came, he went on speaking.
If I had one spark of pity for you, I would now leave you alone. But I have not a spark of pity. The smallest dose of it, and you are lost. Weeping over humanity and bewailing oneself, you know our race's pathological leaning towards it. Our greatest poets destroyed themselves by this poison. Up to 40, 50, they were revolutionaries, and then they became consumed by pity, and the world pronounced them holy. Well, you appear to have the same ambition,
and to believe it to be an individual process, personal to you, something unprecedented. He poured out another glass. You see, my point is this. One may not regard the world as a sort of metaphysical brothel for emotions. That is the first commandment for us. Sympathy, conscience, disgust, despair, repentance and atonement, all these inner processes are for us repellent debauchery. To want to conduct history according to the maxims of the Sunday school means to leave everything as it is. You know that as well as I do. You know the stakes in this game. And here you come talking about Borgrov's whimpering. He emptied his glass. Rubashov sat down on the narrow stool opposite Ivanov and listened. All this was not new to him. He had defended the same point of view for years with the same or similar words. The difference was that at that time he had known those inner processes of which Ivanov spoke so contemptuously, merely as an abstraction. But since then, he had experienced the grammatical fiction as a physical reality in his own body. But had these irrational processes become more admissible merely because he had a personal acquaintance with them now? When a year ago he had sent Oliver to her death, he had not had enough imagination to picture the details of an execution. Would he now behave differently merely because he knew some of its aspects? Either it was right, or it was wrong to sacrifice Richard, Oliver, and little Lurvy. But what had Richard's stutter, the shape of Oliver's breast, or Bogrov's whimpering to do with the objective rightness or wrongness of the measure itself? Ivanov continued. There are only two conceptions of human ethics, and they are at opposite poles. One of them is Christian and humane, declaring the individual to be sacrosanct and asserting that the rules of arithmetic are not to be applied to human units. The other starts from the basic principle that a collective aim justifies all means, and not only allows but demands that the individual should in every way be subordinated and sacrificed to the community, which may dispose of it as an experimentation rabbit or a sacrificial lamb. The first conception could be called anti-vivisection morality. The second, vivisection morality. Humbugs and moralizing dilettantes have always tried to mix the two conceptions. In practice, it is impossible. Up to now, all revolutions have been made by moralizing dilettantes. They were always in good faith and perished because of their dilettantism. We, for the first time, are consequent. Yes, said Rubashov. Yes, so consequent that in the interests of a just distribution of land, we deliberately let die of starvation about 5 million farmers and their families in 1 year. So consequent were we in the liberation of human beings from the shackles of industrial exploitation that we sent about 10 million people to do forced labor in the Arctic regions and the jungles of the East. So consequent that to settle a difference of opinion, we only know one argument, death, whether it is a matter of submarines, manure, or the party line to be followed in Indochina. Acting consequentially in the interests of the coming generations, we have laid such terrible privations on the present one that its average length of life is shortened by a quarter. The people's standard of life is lower than it was before the revolution. The labor conditions are harder. The discipline is more inhuman. The piecework drudgery worse than in colonial countries with native coolies. We have lowered the age limit for capital punishment down to 12 years. Our sexual laws are more narrow-minded than those of England,
Our leader worship more Byzantine than that of the most reactionary dictatorships. We have built up the most gigantic police apparatus, with informers made into a national institution, and with the most refined scientific system of physical and mental torture. We whip the groaning masses of the country towards a theoretical future happiness which only we can see. Those are the consequences of our consequentialness. You called it vivisection morality. To me, it sometimes seems as though the experimenters had torn the skin off the victim and left it standing with bared tissues, muscles, and nerves.
Well, what of it? Said Ivanov. Don't you find it wonderful? We are tearing the old skin off mankind and giving it a new one. That is not an occupation for people with weak nerves, but there was once a time when it filled you with enthusiasm.
Rubashov wanted to answer, since then I have heard Bogrov call out my name. But he knew that this answer did not make sense. So he answered instead, to continue with the same metaphor,
I see the flayed body of this generation, but I see no trace of the new skin. We all thought we could treat history in the way we treat experiments in physics. The difference is that in physics, we can repeat the experiment 1,000 times, but in history, only once. If it should turn out that big submarines would, after all, have been the right thing, Comrade Bogrov will not come to life again. And what follows? Should we sit with idle hands because the consequences of an act are never quite to be foreseen? We vouch for every act with our heads. More cannot be expected of us, can it?
Ivanov looked at his watch. The cell window had turned a dirty grey. The newspaper, which was stuck over the broken pane, swelled and rustled in the morning breeze.
For a man with your past, Ivanov went on, this sudden revulsion against experimenting is rather naive. Every year, several million people are killed quite pointlessly by epidemics and other natural catastrophes. And we should shrink from sacrificing a few 100,000 for the most promising experiment in history. Oh, dear.
He limped over to Rubashov at the window and looked out.
Don't be a fool, Rubashov. Everything I brought up tonight is elementary foreknowledge, which you know as well as I. You were in a state of nervous depression, but now it is over. Now go and sleep it off, old warhorse. Tomorrow the time is up, and we will both need a clear head to concoct your deposition. Now don't shrug your shoulders. You are yourself at least half convinced that you will sign. If you deny it, it's just moral cowardice. Moral cowardice has driven many to martyrdom.
I'll think it over, said Rubashov. When the door had closed behind his visitor, Rubashov knew that he'd already half surrendered. He threw himself on the bunk, exhausted and yet strangely relieved. Bogrov's pathetic appeal had in his memory lost some of its acoustic sharpness. Who could call it betrayal if one kept faith with the living instead of the dead? He woke abruptly. He had slept for an hour, quietly and dreamlessly. Now he felt refreshed. 402 had been tapping on his wall for some time. The fellow was obviously feeling neglected. Rubashov interrupted him. He tapped with his pince-nez. I am capitulating. 402 was silenced. His answer came a whole minute later. I'd rather hang, Rubashov smiled. He tapped.
each according to his kind. He expected an outbreak of anger from 402. Instead, the tapping sounded resigned. I was inclined to consider you an exception. Have you no spark of honor left? Rubashov tapped. Our ideas of honor differ. 402 tapped quickly in reply. Honor is to live and die for one's belief. Rubashov answered. Honor is to be useful without vanity. 402. Honor is decency, not usefulness. Rubashov again. What is decency? Answer. Something your kind will never understand. Rubashov shrugged his shoulders. We have replaced decency with reason, he replied. 402 did not come back. Before supper, Rubashov read through again what he had just written. He made one or two corrections, made a copy of the whole text in the form of a letter addressed to the public prosecutor of the Republic. He ended the document with this sentence. The undersigned, N.S. Rubashov, former member of the Central Committee of the Party, former Commissar of the People, former Commander of the 2nd Division of the Revolutionary Army, bearer of the Revolutionary Order for Fearlessness before the enemy of the people, has decided, in consideration of the reasons exposed above, utterly to renounce his oppositional attitude and to denounce publicly his errors. Rubashov had been waiting for 2 days to be taken before Ivanov. He had thought this would follow immediately after he handed the document announcing his capitulation to the old warder. Time, which had flown so quickly during the first 2 weeks of his arrest, now crawled. He hoped Ivanov himself would come. The whole formality of his deposition would be settled in his cell. He pictured the conversation in detail, how they would together work out the pompous phraseology of the confession and Ivanov's cynical witticisms while they did it. The third night after his conversation with Ivanov, he could not sleep. He lay in the dark on the bunk, listening to the faint, stifled sounds in the building, and for the first time since his arrest, wished for the presence of a warm female body. He fought against the desire to start a conversation with 402, who, since the question, what is decency, had not been heard of again. About midnight, he could no longer hold out and tapped against the wall with his knuckles. He waited eagerly. The wall remained silent. He tapped again. No. 402 still did not answer. He shut his eyes and imagined Arlova lying beside him, the familiar curve of her breast raised against the darkness. And suddenly the cell door was torn open. The light from the corridor stabbed into his eyes. He saw 2 uniformed officials with revolver belts. One of the 2 approached the bunk. He was very tall. He ordered Rubashov to follow him. Rubashov felt for his pince-nez under the blanket, put them on, and got up from the bunk. He walked along the corridor beside the uniformed giant. He looked at his watch. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. They went towards the barber's shop. The second official remained 3 paces behind Rubashov. Rubashov felt the impulse to turn his head in response to an itching in the back of his neck, but controlled it. The narrow cellar staircase came into view. He felt no fear, only curiosity and uneasiness. But when they had passed the staircase, he noticed to his surprise that his legs were shaky. At the same time, he caught himself mechanically rubbing his spectacles on his sleeve. The giant stopped, opened a door, and stood aside. Rubashov saw a room before him similar to Ivanov's, but with unpleasantly bright lighting. Opposite the door, behind the desk, sat a uniformed official with a broad scar across his shaven skull. He looked up from his pile of documents. "Please sit down." The only light in the room came from a tall metal standing lamp behind his chair. The sharp white glow blinded Rubashov, so that it was only after a few seconds that he became aware of a third person, a secretary, sitting behind a screen at a small table with her back to the room. Rubashov sat down in front of the desk, on the only chair. The official said, "My name is Gletkin. I am commissioned to examine you during the absence of Commissar Ivanov." The light of the lamp hurt Rubashov's eyes. "I prefer to be examined by Ivanov."
"The examining magistrate is appointed by the authorities," said Gletkin. "You have the right to make a statement or to refuse. In your case, a refusal would amount to a disavowal of the declaration of willingness to confess, which you wrote 2 days ago, and would automatically bring the investigation to an end. In that eventuality, I have the order to send your case back to the competent authority, who would pronounce your sentence administratively."
Rubashov thought this over quickly. Something had obviously gone wrong with Ivanov. He had to think quickly, and the light hindered him. He took his pince-nez off and blinked. If he now remained silent, he would be lost. There was no going back. "I am ready to make a statement," he said.
How old might this Gletkin be? 36 or 37 at the most. He must have taken part in the civil war as a youth and seen the outbreak of the revolution as a mere boy. That was the generation which had started to think after the flood. It had no traditions and no memories to bind it to the old vanished world. It was a generation born without umbilical cord, and yet it had right on its side. Oh, one must tear that umbilical cord, deny the last tie which bound one to the vain conceptions of honour and the hypocritical decency of the old world. Honour was to serve without vanity, without sparing oneself, and until the last consequence.
Rubashov kept his pince-nez in his hand, turned his face towards Gletkin. He had to keep his eyes shut. Behind his lids shimmered a reddish light. He had never had such an intense feeling of solitude.
"I will do everything which may serve the party," he said. "I beg you to state the accusation in detail."
He noticed that the light of the lamp had become yet another grade more glaring. He was forced to turn his head away completely and wipe his watering eyes.
"You brute," he thought.
"Yet it is just such a generation of brutes that we need now." Gletkin had started to read the accusation. Rubashov listened. He had decided to regard his confession as a formality, as an absurd yet necessary comedy. But the text which Gletkin was reading surpassed his worst expectations in absurdity.
Did Gletkin really believe that he, Rubashov, had planned these childish plots, that for years he'd thought of nothing else than to break up the building, the foundations of which he and the old guard had laid? And that with methods which appeared to have been borrowed from a cheap detective story?
Gletkin was reading about the alleged negotiations with the representative of foreign power, which, it was pretended, Rubashov had started during his stay in Belgium, with the object of a reinstatement of the old regime by force. The name of the foreign diplomat was mentioned, also the time and place of their meeting. Rubashov listened more attentively now. Now Gletkin was at the period of Rubashov's activity at the head of the Aluminium Trust. He read out statistics which showed the appalling disorganization in that too hastily developed branch of industry. The number of workers who had become victims of accidents, the series of aeroplanes crashed as a result of defective material. This all was the consequence of his, Rubashov's, devilish sabotage. The word devilish actually occurred several times in the text. Rubashov turned his head to the stenographer in her dimly lit corner. She was small, thin, and wore spectacles. Obviously, she found the monstrous things Gletkin was reading quite convincing. She was still young, perhaps 25 or 26. She, too, had grown up after the flood. What did the name Rubashov mean to this generation of modern Neanderthalers? Gletkin was the last paragraph of the accusation. It contained the crowning feature, the plot for an attempt on Number One's life. The mysterious X mentioned by Ivanov appeared again. It turned out that he was an assistant manager of the restaurant from which Number One had his cold lunch brought to him on busy days. This cold snack was a feature of Number One's Spartan mode of life, most carefully fostered by propaganda.
And it was just by means of this proverbial cold snack that X, on Rubashov's instigation, was to prepare a premature end for number one. After a few seconds of silence, Gletkin said,
"You have heard the accusation and plead guilty." Rubashov said, so quietly that the thin secretary had to stretch out her head to hear, "I plead guilty to not having understood the inescapable compulsion behind the policy of the government and to having held oppositional views. I plead guilty to having followed sentimental impulses and in doing so to have been led into contradiction with historical necessity. I have lent my ear to the laments of the sacrificed and thus became deaf to the arguments which proved the necessity to sacrifice them. I plead guilty to having rated the question of guilt and innocence higher than that of utility and harmfulness. And finally, I plead guilty to having placed the ideal of man above the ideal of mankind. I know that my aberration, if carried into effect, would have been a mortal danger to the revolution. Humanitarian weakness and liberal democracy, when the masses are not mature, is suicide for the revolution. And yet, my oppositional attitude was based on a craving for liberal reform of the dictatorship, for a broader democracy, for the abolition of the terror, and for a loosening of the rigid organization of the party. I admit that these demands in the present situation are objectively harmful and therefore counter-revolutionary in character. In this sense, and in this sense only, can you call me a counter-revolutionary? With the absurd criminal charges made in the accusation, I have nothing to do." "Have you finished?" asked Gletkin. His voice sounded so brutal that Rubashov looked at him in surprise. Gletkin's brightly lit silhouette showed behind the desk in his usual correct position. Rubashov sought for a simple characterization of Gletkin. Correct brutality. That was it. "Your statement is not new," Gletkin went on. "In both your preceding confessions, the first one 2 years ago, the second time 12 months ago, you have already publicly confessed that your attitude had been objectively counter-revolutionary and opposed to the interests of the people. Now you expect to play the same game a third time. You admit your oppositional attitude, but deny the acts which are the logical consequence of it. This time you will not get off so easily." Gletkin broke off. The light became another grade stronger. "The declarations I made at that time were made for tactical purposes," Rubashov retorted. "You certainly know that a whole row of oppositional politicians were obliged to pay with such declarations for the privilege of remaining in the party. But this time I mean it differently." "That is to say, this time you are sincere," Gletkin suggested.
"Yes.
And before that you lied."
"Call it that.
To save your neck."
"To be able to go on working."
"Without a neck, one cannot work. Hence, to save your neck."
"Call it that."
The lamp gave off cascades of white light and radiated a steady heat which forced Rubashov to wipe the sweat from his forehead. He strained to keep his smarting eyes open, but the intervals at which he opened them became longer and longer. He felt a growing sleepiness. "Your former declarations of repentance had the object of deceiving the party as to your true opinions and of saving your neck."
"I've already admitted that," said Rubashov.
"And your public disavowal of your secretary, Oliver, had that the same object by any chance?"
Rubashov nodded. The pressure in his eye sockets radiated over all the nerves in the right side of his face. He noticed that his tooth had started to throb again.
"You know that Citizen Oliver had constantly called on you as the chief witness for her defence?"
I was informed of it. You also doubtless know, then, that the declaration you made at that time, which you have just described as a lie, was decisive for the passing of the death sentence on Oliver? I was informed of it. So it is possible that Citizen Oliver was innocent. It is possible. And was executed as a consequence of the lying declaration you made with the object of saving your head. Yes, that's about it, said Rubashov, and thought, you scoundrel. But you have me by the throat, and I cannot defend myself, because it is not allowed to throw oneself out of the swing. If only you would let me sleep.
And after all that, you demand to be treated with consideration. You still dare to deny criminal activities? After all that, you demand that we should believe you?
I demand nothing, except to prove once more my devotion to the party. There is only one proof you can give, a complete confession. We have heard enough of your oppositional attitude and your lofty motives. What we need is a complete public confession of your criminal activities, which were the necessary outcome of that attitude. The only way in which you can still serve the party is as a warning example by demonstrating to the masses, in your own person, the consequences to which opposition to the party policy inevitably leads. I can't confess to crimes that I have not committed.